Blues.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, WAMU 88.5 presents the Kojo Namdi Show. Welcome. I'm Kojo Namdi. It's Tech Tuesday. Later in the broadcast, the ideas that form the base of this year's Republican convention and whether disagreement over those ideas between GOP activists and John McCain are important. But first, why some members of Congress are fighting for their right to tweet. The microblogging service Twitter is developing a fast following on Capitol Hill, especially among technophiles who've learned how to send tweets or short text messages to their constituents. But congressional rules aren't exactly tweet-friendly. They set firm limits on where and how lawmakers can post information online. So the Twittering crowd is pushing for those rules to be rewritten, and open government advocacy groups think their tweets could shed a little sunshine on how the government does business. Joining us in studios in St. Paul to discuss this is Andrew Noyes, a reporter at Congress Daily. He also writes the National Journal's blog about the intersection of politics and technology. It's called Tech Daily Dose. Andrew Noyes, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Gabriella Schneider, Communications Director for the Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that uses new internet technologies to make information about Congress and the federal government more accessible. Gabriella, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Andrew, allow me to start with you. 10 years ago, it wasn't all that uncommon for a member of Congress to not even have a website. But now even the least tech-savvy politicians are on the web, and the more sophisticated are moving on to YouTubing and microblogging with Twitter. Twitter is still very new to a lot of us. How does Twitter work?
Well, Twitter is pretty simple. It's a social networking and microblogging service that lets people who subscribe to it send and read other users' updates that they send by their computer or by their handheld device, by BlackBerry or mobile phone. The tweets are text-based posts, and you can post up to 140 characters in length. So that's why it's microblogging. It's just short bursts of information.
Who on Capitol Hill is making the most use of Twitter?
Well, it started out with Representative Culbertson from Texas, and he was joined by quite a few others. You've got some in the leadership, in the Democratic leadership, and the minority twittering, all kinds of members. Some folks that you wouldn't think would be as tech savvy are also joining in.
Congressman Culbertson is a Texas Republican. It is my understanding he is the greatest user of Twitter in the Congress.
That's true. That's true. From what I can tell, he rarely a day goes by when he's not twittering from the House floor or in the corridors of Congress.
Let's have our audience join this Tech Tuesday conversation. You can tell us if you've ever microblogged or sent a friend a tweet. Tell us how you make use of these services by calling 800-433-8850. Do you know what tweeting even is? 800-433-8850. You can send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. Technology tends to move faster than the rules, and the current rules in the House of Representatives limit how and where lawmakers can post information on the web. How does that affect the members who want to use Twitter?
Well, and that's something that members are grappling with right now. Representative Michael Capuano, a Democrat from Massachusetts, chairs the Commission on Mailing Standards, which is the group that sets these rules. And the rules, as you said earlier, are pretty outdated. So he's trying to loosen the existing rules to allow members to post video online, which is what he's starting with. There's been a bit of a misconception by some that the rules that they're addressing at this point would crack down on things other than online video, like Twitter. But at this point, He and his counterparts in the Senate are just working on rules for online video. Folks like John Boehner are worried that, and Jim Culberson are worried that that could start a snowball effect, and more technologies would be implicated.
One of the problems here, of course, is that franking privileges usually allow members of Congress to communicate with their constituents. But if you're going to use Twitter, the problem seems to be, even though it's limited to 140 characters, members of Congress sending anything to an online service that includes advertising. That's the problem.
Right. That's exactly it. The same with YouTube videos. You can embed a YouTube video on a website that has political advertising or, you know, any kind of advertising, and that creates a real problem.
Gabrielle, it's my understanding that the Sunlight Foundation is backing a Let Our Congress Tweet campaign. Your group's in the business of pushing for more government transparency. How does Twitter help to achieve that?
Well, as Andrew mentioned, it's been about 10 years since Congress has looked at the rules that govern how members of Congress can use the Internet to interact with the public. And in that time, you know, the Internet is just moving at such a quick pace and Congress hasn't kept up. We launched at the Sunlight Foundation, letourcongresstweet.org, because as Congress is reconsidering those rules, including the rules that Representative Capuano has introduced, we're saying, great, it's about time you're reconsidering the rules, but when you do, let's not talk about blacklists, and let's really let's let members of Congress engage in one-on-one conversations with the public, where the public is already gathering to share ideas. Members of Congress shouldn't be prevented from gathering in those same places.
Do you agree essentially with Congressman Culberson, who says that the current rules amounts to a gag order on Twitter?
That may be a bit of an exaggeration. There are rules right now, as Andrew had mentioned, about embedding YouTube videos that they're not enforced. And our researchers at the Sunlight Foundation concluded that there have not been any public complaints filed about members of Congress going against franking rules in terms of their use of the Internet.
How many people have signed your tweet petition so far?
Over 700, and that's it's a petition where you go to the website, letourcongresstweet.org, and you can click on the phrase, Congress update the rules, you know, let our Congress tweet. So you have to be already registered on the Twitter service. And I've gotten lots of feedback from citizens who say they support this, but they're not even on Twitter yet.
I just like the word tweet. My best friend in high school was nicknamed Tweet. But he used it as a synonym for sweet, but that's a whole nother story. We're talking with Gabriella Schneider. She is Communications Director for the Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that uses new internet technologies to make information about Congress and the federal government more accessible. We're joining you from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota, where we are, of course, for the Republican National Convention. And Andrew Noyes is also with us. He's a reporter at Congress Daily. He writes the National Journal's blog about the intersection of politics and technology. It's called Tech Daily Dose. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Let's start with Matt in Germantown, Maryland. Matt, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
The show. I just wanted to comment. Actually, when I was calling in, I didn't realize that you had a member of Sunlight Labs or Foundation there. But I wanted to make a comment about publicmarkup.org is a great website that has a legislation that Sunlight Labs is working on, and you can actually go and comment. And I think it's a bigger issue that we need to look at is transparency in government, not just having some Republican congressman sending little microblogs, but actually making the communication channels more open. And I'd like to hear comments, and I'll take my listening off.
Indeed,
we
invited Republican Congressman Culberson to join, but he had a scheduling conflict. Gabriella?
Well, I couldn't have said that better myself. Thanks so much. Yes, so as your caller just mentioned, we're looking at modernizing Congress and advocating for technological reform so we can open up access to improve the way that Congress interacts with the public and vice versa, and hopefully to strengthen the relationship that we all have with our elected officials. So on publicmarkup.org, we posted recently our model transparency bill that looks at anything from updating member web use restrictions and franking rules to strengthening the Freedom of Information Act, creating more open access to legislative information in open formats that can be reused. You'd be surprised how many people want to create mashups of political and governmental information. And we allowed the public to come and comment on our model bill and say where it's weak, where it could be stronger, what we should, you know, what we forgot. And we revised our bill based on that, and we're right now advocating to hopefully get some sponsors for that bill.
Do you tweet in your personal time? Do you use Twitter? Or
I definitely do. I'm StereoGab on Twitter. And it's funny because when I started, I thought, okay, this is going to be just my personal thing, not where I publish information about my work. But, you know, the internet just creates greater transparency for all of our lives. So I'm there, you know, tweeting about crashing parties at both conventions, and I'm tweeting about planting vegetables in my garden back home.
And what's your handle? StereoGab?
StereoGab.
StereoGab on Twitter. That's Gabriella Schneider. Andrew, the Personal Democracy Forum hosted a Twitter debate on technology issues between the McCain and Obama campaign teams earlier this summer. Each campaign was required to answer questions through tweets under the standard 140 words. What do you make of that event?
Well, I find it surprising that any politician can respond to questions in 140 characters.
I am absolutely shocked and amazed.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, I think it's another group really getting involved and moving toward this push for transparency. And I think that both campaigns have very talented and dedicated technology gurus who are kind of helping them navigate these waters.
Is this a format that you expect people to be replicating in the future?
The Twittering?
Sure.
Well, I think the ease of Twitter is what really turns people on. I mean, you can Twitter when you're sitting on the metro on your morning commute. Members, like I said, are Twittering from their seats on the floor of the House and the Senate. So I think the uber mobility of Twitter and the ease of use is what really gets people excited. And you know, it's also a great vehicle to not only share your thoughts about your garden, Gabriella, or whatever, but also really really keep on from Congress's perspective, really keep their constituents up to date on pretty much real time what's happening on Capitol Hill.
We talk about its accessibility, yet David Legess, who writes at U.S. News and World Report, said that following a debate on Twitter is, quoting here, like watching contestants play ping pong in two different rooms. What do you make of that, Gabrielle?
Well, I think that we're all experimenting, and we'll soon see which communication vehicles are the best. But, you know, Twitter is just one of the most popular. I think it's had a 600% growth in the past year. And Congress should not make itself irrelevant, so it should join the conversation where it's happening.
We got this email from Daniel, who said, first, there is not a rule against using Twitter, but there are rules against accepting gifts, campaigning for election, having inaccessible data, for example, video without closed captioning. Many members of Congress have been actually out front in some technologies and within the rules. First electronic message came from the Capitol over 150 years ago by Samuel Morse. So Daniel seems to be suggesting that the rules of Congress, well, frankly, allow for tweeting, except that there are rules against accepting gifts. I'm not quite sure I understand how that rule would be violated if you tweet on a website that does advertising.
Well, and I think that's really the key here. I mean, the members of Capuano's panel within the House Administration Committee and members of the Senate Rules Committee are both trying to figure out what exactly is going on. I mean, rules are pretty vague. I mean, they don't specify.
And that's why we're advocating that they take a look at these rules and finally update them. And I'd invite your very savvy listener to join Sunlight's Open House Project. We've convened a bipartisan collaborative group to examine how the House and soon the Senate use technology and how they can improve their use of technology to make themselves more accessible to the public.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation about tweeting on Twitter. That is, members of Congress sending messages of 140 140 characters or less, so they think that they can communicate more effectively with their constituents and with others. What do you think Congress should get out of getting its members to tweet? 800-433-8850 is the number to call. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation. You can also email us at kojo@wamu.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation on tweeting and Twitter. I'm Kojo Namdi.
This is WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt McCleskey. At 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More.
Next time on Tell Me More, in a special Mocha Moms, we hear from conservative mothers of color about the Republican National Convention and what it's like to be a minority within a minority, an African-American Republican.
Don't make assumptions. There's, you know, a place for everyone, and all African-Americans don't have to be Democrats.
I'm Deborah Amos. Special coverage of the RNC and the Mochas. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock. Then at 3, it's Fresh Air.
General David Petraeus has been cast in the presidential campaign as a sort of oracle that must be consulted by both candidates when considering the future of Iraq. So writes journalist Steve Cole. Cole profiles Petraeus in an article titled The Formula, General Petraeus and the Way Out of Iraq, published in this week's New Yorker. We'll talk with Cole on the next Fresh Air.
That's coming up at 3 o'clock, then at 4 on All Things Considered, an update on all the day's top news, including the latest from the WAMU 88.5 news team.
A new website is trying to match up people who want to carpool as long commute times get back to normal in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm Matt Bush, and I'll have more on that during All Things Considered on WAMU 88.5.
That's All Things Considered, beginning at 4.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Phillips Collection, offering university-accredited art history courses, including issues in contemporary art and 20th century American comics. Courses for students and lifelong learners begin September 8th. Details at illinois@thephillips.org.
And now the Kojo Namdi Show continues live from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Welcome back. It's Tech Tuesday. We are in St. Paul, Minnesota for the Republican National Convention, broadcasting from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio with Andrew Noyes, a reporter at Congress Daily. He also writes the National Journal's blog about the intersection of politics and technology. It's called Tech Daily Dose. And today we're talking on this Tech Tuesday about tweeting and Twitter. Also with Gabriella Schneider, Communications Director for the Sunlight Foundation, which uses new internet technologies to make information about Congress and the federal government more accessible. And the argument being made here is that allowing members of Congress to use Twitter will, in fact, make information about the workings of Congress more accessible. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Andrew, some Republicans started tweeting furiously during what they called their guerrilla session in the House chamber in August. They stayed on the House floor after Speaker Nancy Pelosi adjourned the chamber for August recess, and they kept debating, even though the lights had been turned off. Was that a big moment for Twitter on the Hill, or is it more of a stunt?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think it was a big moment for Twitter. It was a big moment for members being able to reach out directly to their constituents even when the cameras are turned off and the doors are barred. I think it was also a stunt. I mean, I think it was definitely something that was coordinated and got them quite a bit of attention.
I was about to say, Gabriella, did that also draw members of the public's attention to Twitter more?
I'm sure it helped. I think earlier in the summer when there was all the Twittering and more members of Congress started signing up and tweeting themselves, when the new rules that Capuano introduced, that really galvanized the public and raised awareness about how Congress can or cannot use social media.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. When Congress comes back to Washington this month, they'll have a lot of work on their hands. Are they going to have time to update these communications rules, or is this something that'll get pushed back to the next session?
Well, we're hoping that they do update them, and we're working closely with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, and we'll soon be launching an open Senate project to make sure the rules are updated for the Senate as well. And I would just like to say that as members of Congress come back into session and more are starting to tweet, you'll be able to see exactly who's Twittering and who's not on congresspedia.org.
Here's Andrew.
Right. I just to give a bit more detail about the state of play in the House and the Senate, the Capuano's panel is still finalizing its proposal. There's been an alternate proposal that's been put out there by several other members that the Republicans see as being maybe a little more palpable. On the Senate side, the Senate Rules Committee, led by Dianne Feinstein and Bob Bennett, hope to have a final version of their language shortly after Congress comes back.
A lot of politicians on the Hill have been experimenting with blogging and with posting video. How are they likely to be affected by the new rules?
Well, I think we won't really know a whole lot until we see what the final rules are. It's interesting to note, circling back to Jim Culbertson, he's also a pioneer, along with Representative Tim Ryan, of another technology called Quick Video. And it basically lets you stream live video from your cell phone, from wherever you are. So it's another upcoming technology that not very many folks are getting on board with quite yet.
Allow me to go to David in Silver Spring, Maryland. David, you are now on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you very much for taking the call.
You're welcome.
My comment is, don't we have enough bird heads in Congress as it is? I don't think that they're technologically challenged. I think rather that they're mentally challenged with trying to get things done. I email my congresspeople, and they email me back. They know my opinion on various things, and I get their opinion about why they didn't do what I wanted them to do.
Well, wouldn't you be interested in getting more frequent communications from your member of Congress through Twitter, in which your member of Congress won't be, you know, filling you with a lot of hot air? He'll be simply, or she will simply be sending you 140 characters, updating you on either the issue you raised or trying to have a conversation with you on Twitter.
No, consider the number of areas that they have to cover. If you go to one of your congressmen's websites and they'll ask, what is your area of inquiry about? And there must be 30 of them. No, I don't want to hear about 30 different kinds of things coming from people all the time. I'm jammed up enough as it is with spam on my ordinary email.
David, I suspect that Gabriela Schneider begs to differ. Gabriela Schneider begs to differ.
I sure do, Kojo. So what I've been witnessing is that when you email your member of Congress, you may get a personalized communication back. But what I'm seeing on Twitter, and I'd love to see more of, is one-on-one conversations where you can see at John Culbertson responds to at Banderista, well, this is the reason why I'm right here, right now, about to vote. It's about real-time communication. It's about being able to make your voice heard just as Congress is about to vote on something as important as whether or not we're going to tap oil reserves or not.
Andrew Noyes, both of the presidential campaigns have been sending tweets to their supporters. How do you think Twitter's helped them so far in this campaign?
Well, I think it's part of a much larger effort that I've been writing about this week here in St. Paul. That really underscores the technology, the greater adoption of technology, and using the web to really communicate with voters. In the case of the Obama and McCain campaigns, I think it's probably helped their campaigns quite a bit.
Do you feel the same way, Gabriela?
Well, like I said, I'd love to see more direct communication using these communication technologies. And I think it's great that they've been able to mobilize folks. But I'd like to see less of the kind of PR push.
Famous last words from Stereo Gab.
Thanks.
Gabriela Schneider is the communications director for the Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonprofit that uses new internet technologies to make information about Congress and the federal government more accessible. Gabriela, thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so much, Kojo.
Andrew Noyes is a reporter at Congress Daily. He also writes the National Journal's blog about the intersection of politics and technology. It's called Tech Daily Dose. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will discuss the Republican National Convention's party platform here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, our live coverage from the Twin Cities continues as we explore why lobbyist has become a four-letter word on the campaign trail. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Then at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, in a special Mocha Moms, we hear from conservative mothers of color about the Republican National Convention and what it's like to be a minority within a minority, an African-American Republican.
Don't make assumptions. There's, you know, a place for everyone, and all African-Americans don't have to be Democrats.
I'm Deborah Amos. Special coverage of the RNC and the Mochas. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock right after the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Navigation Arts, driving business value by optimizing the online user experience. Internet strategy, information architecture, and web content management. Navigation Arts, architects of the user experience. On the web at navigationarts.com.
And now, the Kojo Namdi Show continues live from St. Paul, Minnesota, here on WAMU 88.5.
In a perfect world, elections are won by those with the best ideas, but we all know this is not a perfect world, and in the world we do live in, elections are often won by those who can raise the most money and stay out of trouble for the longest amount of time. So what, then, are we to make of the time-honored tradition the parties go through every 4 years when they get together and craft a platform on everything from energy to immigration? After all, the platforms aren't binding documents, and they usually get little attention beyond the party's inner circles. But this year, people are paying attention to the Republicans' platform. That's because it takes a different stance from presidential candidate John McCain on some key issues like abortion and gay marriage. Some say this agreement shows a healthy debate within the Republican ranks. Others say it's another sign of the rift between the GOP presidential candidate and his party. Joining us in the studios at Minnesota Public Radio here is Anthony O'Donnell, minority leader of the Maryland House of Delegates. He represents District 29C, which includes Calvert and St. Mary's counties. Delegate O'Donnell, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you here, Kojo, and appreciate it.
Before we talk about the platform, let's talk about what's going to happen at the convention today. The schedule was limited yesterday. What can you tell us about what it's going to be happening today?
Well, today we're going to have some great speakers. I think we'll begin the process of getting back on track, but it's important to acknowledge that Senator McCain directed the campaign and the delegates to rise to the occasion and, you know, put our Americanism first. We're Americans first. We're partisans second. And our fellow Americans on the Gulf Coast were in harm's way. And so we got into a service mode, changed our schedule a little bit, and I think today we'll be working back towards it. We will hear from, you know, some great party leaders tonight, and the excitement will start to build again.
Essentially, the convention seems to be returning to a more conventional, traditional mode today. Is that what's really going on?
I think so, but the delegations are continuing their service orientation. I know many of our fellow delegations in Maryland will be doing the same. We'll be going down to the Minneapolis Convention Center to pack care packages for folks down on the Gulf Coast who have been hit pretty hard by a devastating storm.
So yesterday you were Americans, and today you're turning back to combining being Americans and being partisans.
Well, I don't think that's not a fair shot, Kojo. Actually, we're always Americans, and we have a long tradition. America has a long tradition of when the chips are down and when times are tough, whether it's war, natural disaster, fiscal or financial calamity, we pull together. We're Americans first. You saw that strongly after September 11th, 2001, and we should never forget that. That is not to say we don't have our own philosophical and ideological beliefs, strong beliefs. You saw it in Denver last week, and you will see it in Minnesota here. We don't check those partisan values and ideals at the door when we are Americans. They're not mutually exclusive terms.
We essentially posed the same question yesterday to Virginia Attorney General Bob McDonnell about whether and when this convention should return to a traditional kind of convention. We caught up with the Virginia Attorney General on the floor of the convention shortly after speeches by First Lady Laura Bush and Cindy McCain.
I'm hopeful that the convention schedule will return to normal tomorrow. I think that there's a tremendous amount of things that have been done to help hurricane victims already. There's been hundreds of thousands of dollars already raised here from the delegates. John McCain's personally donated $25,000. But I think the American people also understand this convention's been planned for years, and that we have the business and the duty to nominate a president. And this is our turn to do that. And while we're having prayer vigils and making donations, that at the same time we're going to go and do the business of the Republican Party. So I'm hopeful that tomorrow it'll be back on track.
And it seems indeed to be getting back on track today. The Republican Party platform, Delegate O'Donnell, was drafted before the formal start of this convention. It's my understanding it was put together by a 112-person committee of which you are or were a member. How does that process work?
Yeah, it's a great process. This is the first time I've had the honor of taking part in it. Each state and the various territories, the District of Columbia as well, each send one man and one woman from each state. So those representatives, those delegates come together to write and present the party's platform. Now, we took a different approach. Under the leadership of Representative Kevin McCarthy of California and Senator Richard Burr, we took a different approach as a committee to, one, make our platform more readable. So in the end, we ended up...
Didn't want it to read like the tax code, right?
Yeah, in the past, you're right. They've become somewhat irrelevant to the process, kind of an anachronism. We wanted to make them more vital again, bring them back into the process so people, Americans, could easily read, you know, what we believe, what we stand for, where we're going to go, where we want to take the country. And so we went from about 40,000 some words down to 20,000 some words from 4 years ago, about half the size. I brought a copy with me today. It's very, very readable. One, two, and I know you just had a segment on technology, the intersection of technology and politics. We used technology for the first time, unlike any major political party ever has, where we opened up a website and we invited Americans. Senator McCain invited Americans from all across the country. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you want in our platform. I think some 14,000 responses, and they come in, Kojo, in many different manners, email, letter, calls, and some even took the time to produce YouTube-like videos and little productions and little jingles. So it was quite humorous, but we had great input from across the political spectrum into our platform, and the debate process was very open. For 3 days, we sat around and hammered it out. We started out in subcommittees. I served on the Energy and Environment Subcommittee. And we actually had good, open, vigorous debate, which is something that the Republican Party does cherish.
And you can find a link to that 20,000-word document that is the Republican Party platform on our website at kojoshow.org. You can join this conversation by calling 800-433-8850. Just how important do you think a party platform is in a presidential campaign? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. We're talking with Anthony O'Donnell, minority leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. He represents District 29. See, Delegate O'Donnell, you mentioned that you were honored to be in this position. How does one get chosen as a member of the platform committee? Is this a role that people fight over?
Well, in Maryland, the way we did it was the state party had a meeting of its delegation to the national convention. Of course, we elect some of those members and alternates on the ballot. The state party has the ability to elect certain other members. Once we put our delegation together, then there was people who displayed their interest for said subcommittees. There were committees. There were four of those, actually, and one of them being platform. I expressed an interest, and my fellow delegates bestowed that honor upon me through an election process.
Getting 112 people to agree on anything, much less key political issues, seems like a near impossibility. But you know about this stuff. You sit in the Maryland General Assembly. What do you do when people disagree on a major topic?
Well, you know, you debate the merits of the issue, pros and cons, just like anywhere else in the political discourse. And then the stronger argument rises and wins. But I will tell you, we were united. And I have to disagree with the characterization that the platform is out of sync with the candidate that we have in the Republican Party. It's not. It's very much in sync.
Well, it seems to me that there are parts that are in sync and parts not so much. For instance, the platform calls for a constitutional amendment defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. That is a reform that Senator McCain, as far as I know, is opposed to. You. Yeah. Do you think that that disagreement represents a fracture between the party and its candidate?
Absolutely not, Kojo. And it's important for the listeners to understand the platform is the party platform. It's what the party believes. However, I would dare to say if we have millions of members in our party, and not every member is going to agree with every sentence, every plank, every splinter in that platform. That's not what the platform is. It's an ideological statement about what we believe in general. And this platform is not just the presidential candidate's platform. It is the party platform.
So that people who are running for everything from members of state legislators and county councils and city councils and dog catchers who happen to be Republican can relate to this platform.
Absolutely. And you know, I also have to say that our platform is probably in its current format, and I think we have a major upgrade this time around on our platform, but our platform is probably more in sync with a broader range of our party than any platform of any major political party in the history of politics, or modern history anyway.
Do you have questions about the Republicans' party platform or about Maryland politics? You can call us at 800-433-8850 or send your email to kojo@wamu.org. I'd also read a news report claiming that the platform called for a constitutional amendment banning abortion. In our readings of the platform, we came across language calling for a human life amendment. Can you explain what that means and how the platform addresses this issue?
Yeah. Again, remember that the platform is not a legislative document.
Yes.
It is a philosophical document. It's a philosophical statement. So, you know, the crafting of a human life amendment, of course, would have to go through a rigorous process where the, you know, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. But what it is a statement that the Maryland Republican Party has a strong valuation and high premium on human life. And, you know, we are not a party that endorses other conveniences over human life. Human life for us is at the essence of our existence.
The platform says, quoting here, a child has a fundamental individual right to life which cannot be infringed. We support a human life amendment to the Constitution, and we endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to unborn children.
Absolutely. Absolutely critical. And I will say this, that when the framers said that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, those being among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it's not lost on me that life is first and that we do have an inalienable right to life, and we don't allow others to make the decision whether that life comes forward. We believe it comes from a higher authority.
And you mentioned earlier that your delegation, Maryland Republicans, support that.
Absolutely.
Allow me to go to Earl in Fairfax, Virginia. Earl, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Nnamdi, I had a comment for your guest. He mentioned that not every Republican, of course, would agree with every aspect of the platform. But with the recent disclosure from the vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, about her daughter expecting a child, I know there are some issues in their platform that is not consistent with that. And the final comment I wanted to make, it's not an issue of things happen with members and children, but it seems that the Republican Party has been somewhat hypocritical in judgment of others who have those same types of circumstances in their lives. But yet when that happens, someone in their own party, I believe they're not looking at the hypocrisy that is more of an issue with the general public.
Well, Earl, as I put that question to Delegate O'Donnell, allow me to remind our listeners that yesterday Senator Barack Obama issued a statement indicating that in his view, the children of candidates for office are off limits in a public discussion. But you do raise an issue having to do with the Republican Party platform, and that is, Delegate O'Donnell, does the party platform address the issue of abstinence education?
Well, of course, we all strive for abstinence. We know that teen pregnancy is a large, big problem, It's a big societal problem, and I think it's as a statement of ideal, we should strive to reduce that. Who could be against that? I mean, is the opposite of that being in favor of high teenage pregnancy rates? Of course we're not in favor of that, although we know it happens, of course. We also, as we just talked about, value life. And I think it's important to note that in many areas of America, this baby that's been created with Governor Palin's daughter would have been put away. And that's a very different culture represented by a very different ideology in the other party.
I also ran across a study this morning that indicated that if children are exposed to sex education, they are 60% less likely to have children out of wedlock as teenagers than they are if they are only exposed to abstinence education. And that is an issue that is likely to be raised in this convention.
Well, I'm sure it will, but some of us believe, and I'm a father of three, a grandfather of two, and some of us believe strongly that although what you say may have merit, that it's not some other person's job to do that I don't even know. It's my job as a parent to take care of that business.
The Republican platform also talks quite a bit about energy issues and states explicitly that humans have contributed to climate change. Can you talk a little bit about the energy aspect of the platform?
We made a very strong statement in achieving energy independence. We support accelerated exploration, drilling, development of American energy sources. Now, we believe in renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, oil, natural gas, nuclear. But, you know, it appears to me that in the Democratic Party platform, they don't want nuclear. They don't want to drill. They don't want to develop American sources of energy. And windmills aren't going to cut it. We need baseload generation. We need other energy sources. We have a great neighbor to the north in Canada with valuable resources. We're sending $700 billion a year to people who are hostile to the existence of the American way of life, and we should stop it, and we should make American energy, and we should make it now.
This platform does seem to suggest that the Republican Party is shifting away from the debate over whether global warming exists. I know that Senator McCain is one who certainly believes that global warming exists, but the party platform now seems to be suggesting that we should move on to talking more about how we can save energy and what we can do than debating whether or not global warming actually exists.
Well, we talk about climate change, and there's been climate change on this globe for probably as long as the globe has been around. We've seen the coming and the receding of ice ages. We've seen the warming and the cooling of the earth, and that's climate change, and it occurs, and no one can refute that. Now, you can have a long debate about what causes that, what are the causes and what are the effects, but look, we acknowledge that even if in the end it's shown that man is not the major cause of this, we still believe it's healthy to reduce the emissions into our air. We still believe it's healthy to fix some of our environmental problems. And so we've made a very strong policy statement in the environmental area that, for instance, we can generate electrical power through nuclear energy, safe, reliable, and clean. It's a very strong statement, without putting greenhouse gas emissions into the environment.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. Let's go to Zeke in Baltimore, Maryland. Zeke, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks a lot, Kojo. I understood that your guest was talking about the platform as a philosophical, not a legal document. But he mentioned the 14th Amendment, which requires that all individuals be treated equally under the law. And he said that must be applied, or it's their philosophy, that needs to be applied to unborn children. So would they require the insurance commissioner in every state or in Maryland to allow me to take out life insurance, let's say, on a newly conceived fetus? Would they require them to pay death benefits on that fetus? Would I be allowed to take a tax deduction, a federal tax deduction, on a newly conceived person who is 10 months away from breathing air? That's my question.
Yeah. Tricky question, Zeke. Hang on, let me answer. We only got limited time. Let me just say this. You can be in favor of life, but that doesn't mean that the tax code doesn't stop claiming an individual at age 18 for tax purposes. That doesn't mean you get to claim them the rest of their life for a tax deduction. And there has to be some, maybe some limitations on the bottom end, too. So, you know, those kind of questions, I think, demean when human life starts. Barack Obama said it's above his pay grade to define when human life starts, and I'm offended by that. He's creating law. He's advocating public policy that recognizes when or when it doesn't. Don't say it's above his pay grade. That, to me, is very offensive.
But then individuals can differ on their own view of when life begins.
Absolutely can.
Here is a email we got from Jonathan who says, as a Republican, I'm somewhat disgusted at the new official Republican platform. How was this document put together? Was it open to all members of the party, or were only delegates of the party open to the formation of the new platform? Your guest mentioned a website with an online forum, etc., and frankly, you can find a link to that website at our website, kojoshow.org. But was this forum open to any member of the Republican Party?
Actually, it was open to any member of the public. It wasn't even just limited to Republicans, and we had many Democrats, independents, libertarians, Green Party folks, vegetarians. They all applied and put in their commentary. And so it was the most open process of the Republicans or Democrats or any other major political party that the country has ever seen. So, you know, the gentleman sends in an email saying he's not happy, but it was absolutely open. In fact, it was the most open, transparent process that's ever existed for a party platform.
It's my understanding that the platform committee decided not to include language about drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which was part of the platform in 2004. Why did you and your colleagues decide to leave it out this
Actually,
time?
We decided not to specify, with one exception, not to specify specific places, but we did add language that says onshore resources in Alaska. And so, you know, we believe, many of us believe that we should, including the vice presidential candidate, we should explore all of our potential resources. And, you know, we have so much opportunity in this country, so much opportunity for coming together, you know, liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats to fix this thing. And yet in the media and shows like this and interviews and people just want to kind of drive wedges and pull it apart. You know, I had a discussion this year with the Maryland leader, I believe, of the AFL-CIO, Mr. Greco, and he and I are on the same page with respect to development of nuclear energy. Here's an opportunity for union tradespeople, union workers, and industrialists, and conservationists, and business activists, and environmentalists to get together. Build a nuclear power plant creates jobs, creates wealth, creates energy that's reliable, safe, and clean. Why don't we do this instead of trying to split everybody apart? You know,
it's my understanding that the Democratic candidate for president, Barack Obama, supports the expansion of nuclear.
Absolutely not. That's not true.
Okay, well, we'll have to check
that out, please.
We'll have to check into that. But what do you say to people who say, look, no matter how much domestic drilling we do, it will not provide us with enough oil or enough energy to fill our demands? We have to start changing the way we behave if we are to end our dependence on oil from the Middle East and other sources.
I think that's partially true because we agree that all of the above, conservation, renewable, many other sources are important. So that's part of the answer. But neither one, you know, either developing more resources or conserving what we have is an adequate answer alone. We must do all of the above. And so that's what we advocate.
You know, we like to think that it's the issues are what drive people to the polls. And we had that conversation yesterday with Virginia Attorney General Bob McDonnell. You know, we've been discussing issues here for the last half an hour or so. Well, the Attorney General suggested that the issues are indeed particularly important in this election season.
Ultimately, elections are about ideas, not about conventions and fireworks and speeches. It's about who's got the best ideas for America. And I think that on energy and national security and domestic policy, particularly taxes and spending and regulations, John McCain's a superior candidate, and Virginia's still a slightly right-of-center state. And that when after Labor Day, after today, when people focus once again on the issues, people will realize John McCain's the most experienced candidate with the best judgment and the best ideas for America.
You know, right now we're talking about Governor Palin and her daughter and her husband. We talk about the scandals of the week. We talk about the horse race. We talk about whether or not Obama is a celebrity or not. To what extent do you think the real issues are what people vote on? Because so much of what we talk about is not the issues at all.
Well, I think that's true. We're also not talking about Joe Biden. How about that, Coach?
That's right.
But I think you're right to a certain extent. And we need to get this country back to talking about the country's problems, not one party over the other. And that's the strength of John McCain. He's lived his life with country first. When he was in the prison over there, he didn't put himself first and take an easy pass out. He put his country first, his fellow Americans first. He's dealt that way. You know, he's tagged as a maverick. He's told our party, I disagree. With all due respect, I disagree on many issues. He's put his country first in his opinion. And he's lived his life continuously like that. I think Sarah Palin did the same thing in Alaska. She told the powers that be there, I'm not going to play ball with you. I'm a different kind of candidate.
But the Washington Post today has a story on the front page that she says she sought some $27 million in earmarks for the small town of which she was mayor during her tenure.
Oh, Kojo, I'm shocked the Washington Post
shocked.
Would write a story non-flattering to a Republican presidential nominee or vice presidential nominee. Please.
Shocked. You are the minority leader of a state that's typically considered quite blue. How does that political reality affect the way you approach party politics, both at this convention and afterwards?
Yeah, I think it's important for us to articulate our differences. We have to pick the right tone at the right time. However, we should not become a lesser version of the opposition. We need to say what we believe in. The citizens will decide if that's adequate or not, if that's accurate or not, and I can live with that, but we shouldn't compromise our core beliefs in that process. I will say that the latest poll I saw for the state of Maryland in the presidential election showed it at about a 10-point differential, which is, for a state like Maryland with a 2-to-1 Democrat to Republican voter registration ratio is fairly significant, and I think you might see a closer race than we have in the past.
And then we talk to the chairman of GOPAC, Michael Steele. We'll ask him what he intends to do to close that gap. Anthony O'Donnell is minority leader of the Maryland House of Delegates. He represents District 29C, which includes Calvert and St. Mary's counties. He was or is on the platform committee of the Republican National Committee, and he is here in St. Paul, Minnesota for this convention. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Kojo. Always a pleasure.
And good luck to you at this convention. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, our roadshow from the Republican Convention continues with insight into what a McCain administration would mean for the Supreme Court, plus the Minnesota melting pot, how an influx of new immigrants is affecting culture and politics in the Gopher State. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. The second hour of today's Kojo Nandi Show is coming up next.